in the past 6 weeks, this is the sixth week, on a number of topics related to Hindus in the diaspora. And we talked about various things about their beliefs and sacred space and case studies of how these communities exist in UK context and also South African context. And so today I thought I would kind of bring some of those things together and raise some theoretical questions and see how we can actually sum up Hindus in the diaspora and see what they're up to and what we can say about them. Are there any generalizations possible? And how does that impact on our broader understanding of Hinduism and so on? So I will probably get to these things in a convoluted way, so it's kind of not very direct often times. So I sort of put the theme for today, orality and text, popular and classical, tradition and change, in some kind of polarities, to see how these polarities actually interface in the context of diaspora, and see how or what we make of them. So let me begin. The divide between... There is some notes, I hope everybody got something. Between these polarities is nothing new. The polarities between orality, text, popular, classical, etc., have been observed in general in the context of Indian studies, especially among anthropologists on the one hand, and classical Indologists on the other, both emphasizing two sets of different ways of understanding India through different materials and so on. And in the context of this divide, what is agonizing for any generalizations is especially the privileging of elitist tradition, the so-called elitist traditions, namely Brahmanical traditions and so on, has been from time to time called into question, especially in the emerging what is now known as subaltern studies. Since the 1980s, there's a new surge. After the post-independence in India, you have a whole range of post-colonial studies, critique of colonialism, and all of that. Now, one of the criticisms leveled against that critique of colonialism itself is, in a way, it privileged still the elite discourse. In other words, on the one hand, these critics of colonial enterprise and all of that were themselves products of colonialism, and produced in a kind of devious way, kind of a slanted colonial sort of discourse. Subaltern scholars tended to critique the critique of colonialism, as it were. So it's kind of a criticism of the criticism. Here I have a quote from Sumit Sarkar. He says, "The early essays of Ranajit Guha in Subaltern Studies located the origins of the new initiative in an effort to rectify the elitist bias, often accompanied by economic assumptions common to much colonialist, bourgeoisie, nationalist, and conventional Marxist readings of modern Indian history. Thus, it was argued with considerable justice by Guha and other contributors that anti-colonial movements had been explained far too often in terms of a combination of economic pressures and mobilization from the top by leaders portrayed as manipulative in colonial and as idealistic or charismatic in nationalist historiography. Studies of peasant and labor movements similarly had concentrated on economic conditions and left organizational and ideological lineages. The new trend would seek to explore neglected dimension of popular or subaltern autonomy in action, consciousness, and culture, unquote. There seems to be a link between the subaltern studies and diaspora studies. And this is when I actually looked at some of these subaltern studies, because the issues seem to be similar. For example, the issue of identity and difference in both cases expressed in the broader colonial experience. The recent subaltern studies have brought to fore the elitist discourse's attempt to avoid internal differences in the identity construction. On the one hand, the Hindutva movement's insistence made caste distinctions as irrelevant in defining Hindu, as long as one's origin is traced to Bharatavarsha, the land of Bharata. Later on, at the bottom, I have given this Malviya's definition of Hinduism, which you will see how broad it is. And the experience of both Maharashtra and Bengal reveal, incidentally, both in the context of Maharashtra and Bengal, colonial studies, post-colonial studies, and subaltern studies seem to really take place in those two, you know, states, really, in a serious way, because both of them present interesting examples of how the regional conflicts among social groups and so on have surfaced. And some of the leading sort of social reformers seem to have also incidentally come from these regions. In the context of the diaspora studies, the discourse on identity and difference is equally polarized between attempts towards unity and expression of individuality. Just to kind of digress a little, in the context of what is now known as spirituality, in contradistinction to religion, there seems to be among scholars such as Paul Hela and Helas. Others.
Helas,
yes, I think, yeah, Paul Helas. I was probably thinking of Paul Dunder and Linda Woodhead and others. There seems to be a rise of spirituality, and this is traced to the increasing tendency among people to be more subjective in their selection and choice of things and so on. In other words, the increasing subjectivity in postmodern world is actually leading to a kind of a dissatisfaction about their established churches, established religious affiliations, and so on, and hence looking toward other options, other alternatives, and so on. And these other alternatives are not often necessarily taking on any specific direction. In other words, they're not, say, for instance, leaving the church and going and becoming, say, Buddhists or, you know, Hindus or whatever. But in an eclectic way, they are selecting things from a whole variety of, garden variety of things. So that seems to be, you know, this could range anywhere from early European pagan belief systems to modern Hindu, you know, yoga and all kinds of things. And there seems
to be New Age studies, isn't it?
Yes. Right.
So he calls it detraditionalized.
Yeah.
As opposed to the traditional forms.
Yes.
It's where people can just mix and match and then move.
Yeah.
It's quite a fluid movement of people, as you say.
Yeah.
It's not organizational, it's more on your subjective personal experience.
I mean, they did a study on Britain and USA as to why there is a simultaneous increase among spiritual groups and, you know, these groups that are aligned with spirituality and so on, and decline in the numbers in the, you know, established churches and other religious organizations and so on. Mainly they looked at Christian churches and so on, different denominations vis-a-vis these other things, and they seem to attribute that change to people becoming subjective in their life in the face of increasing, I think the postmodern experience of multiculturalism is probably one factor in that sense.
Might be necessary to distinguish between the United States and Europe.
Yes.
I think a deeper examination reveals that it's only Europe that is getting less and less religious.
Well, even that you've got to be careful, because Ireland has got the most.
Yeah.
I think highest percentage of churchgoers anyway. Particularly in the UK, it's certainly true.
That's
statistically
absolutely
true.
And probably roughly the rest of Europe as well.
Yeah.
But the United States is becoming, in fact, more and more dogmatically religious, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think if you then compare that with the attendance in, say, established mainline churches, what one would call mainline churches, say, Methodists, Presbyterians, and Lutherans, and so on, there is this charismatic churches, you know, Pentecostal and all these other churches. The number is increasing. The Southern Baptists, you know, it's going up. But I think the comparisons are usually made between mainline churches and the other. In fact, I think Paul Healers would actually include the charismatic churches in the spirituality area. So
they might be a bit cross not to be thought mainline.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, and then I would go on to look at Featherstone's analysis of identity issues in post-national, post-colonial context, and he shows that there are two phases in identity construction process. One is the colonization process, during which lower classes, that is the immigrants and so on, sense their inferiority, and in the second phase they demonstrate a sense of repulsion, differentiation, and emancipation. He suggests that it is in the second phase that the rising groups gain in power and confidence, and the upper group is forced to withdraw into greater isolation and restraint. Hence the contrast and tensions in society increase. Now, I'm not sure how remarkable this is in the context of UK, but I can see the strong sort of visible aspect of this in the context of South Africa. If you look at, you know, in the apartheid period, the blacks, the non-white communities, went through that process of attempting to integrate and trying to assimilate the features of the European society and so on. And all of a sudden, post 91-92, once the unbanning of ANC takes place, there is this sudden surge of, you know, black consciousness, what Mbeki today calls African Renaissance, you know, Africanization. And all of these things suddenly come to the center, you know, of the debate. In other words, it is no longer out of fashion to talk about the importance of the Inyangas, for instance, you know, the faith healers. the traditional healers. And in fact, even claiming that traditional healing systems have a cure for HIV/AIDS. So, in other words, the local traditional knowledge systems suddenly come to the center, you know, of the debate, and thereby claiming a kind of a significant ground in the, you know, in the debate between European and African kind of, you know, sort of polarizations. In the context of the diasporas, the second stage is crucial, for in this stage, a certain amount of equalization and demonopolization takes place. And Featherstone says, the outsider groups gain in relative power and oppose their own courts and manners more confidently to those of the established. So in other words, they don't somehow feel like shying away from their own cultures, manners and customs and so on. In understanding the diaspora Hindus in the context of globalization, in three ideas seems to me are important. Oftentimes, the phenomenon of globalization is seen as bringing in economic capital as the most important thing. But social scientific research suggests more important other factors such as social, cultural, and body capital. In other words, how people actually use their body to kind of construct their identity. If you look at the music industry, for instance, the pop, reggae, and R&B, all this music, you know, the people who actually are involved in this music, you actually see how they dress up and how they, you know, demonstrate. You know, the body becomes an important medium through which they, you know, indicate their message, really.
The body is the message.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for Bono, for instance, last night I was watching this, the UK Music Hall of Fame induction, and the Beatles, it was the first and the second person to be inducted was Madonna. And who else used the body more than her in the pop culture, you know? So it was kind of... Yeah, well, Beatles really set the standards, really. And, so they were justifiably the first ones to be inducted into the UK Hall of Fame. Social scientists describe this thing with an interesting word called habitus. You know from, I think you would know more about these French connections here. Peter, how do you say that? Baudot and Norbert Elias. Peter Baudot and Norbert Elias. Both have used the ideas of habitus embodiment in their works extensively. Now, habitus simply refers to a habitual state of approaching others and the world, and is the source of our particular embodied tastes in food, consumer goods, and or art. In other words, it's the locus that we create for ourselves, and that would be through various ways: the food that we eat, the customs, the manners, the art, consumer goods, everything. When groups move from the outside into a given social space, they come with a habitus into another habitus. In the initial stages, they eagerly attempt to acquire the aspects of the habitus of the local social space, and then after a while they begin to reject the local social space and reassert their original habitus. Now this means they would have to rework their habitus, which is not easy. In other words, they come with a habitus, they enter this other habitus, and then they modify their own habitus in the face of this other. And then they, after a while, reassert their original habitus, and then in the process, what emerges out of that is not necessarily exactly what they actually brought, but it's something new. I mean, this reminds me of, in a way, a kind of a hermeneutic circle that Gadamer talks about. You know, what he talks about, fusion of horizons. And, you know, there is this interpretation of what is there, and then new interpretations come in. And then the new interpretation is no longer new, it becomes part of the original interpretation. And then new elements come in, and then this circle of interpretation goes on in a circular way. So, of course, the cycle then becomes bigger and bigger. So he kind of sees a never-ending kind of cycle of hermeneutical circle. Of course, Habermas questions it, and he the question here is it possible to stand out of tradition and critique tradition? For Gadamer, well, you can critique, but then that critique becomes part of the tradition again at some level. But for Habermas, no, you can step out of the tradition. You can critique tradition and step out and create an entirely new this thing. But that, you know, of course, both are coming from different hermeneutical kind of, you know, Habermas being a heavily social scientific kind of a fellow. And so it kind of reminded me of that kind of debate. This reworking can then take place in the diaspora Hindu context, anywhere from building temples to listening to Gurudwara temple music in taxis on the way from or to Heathrow Airport.
Already anywhere else?
Yeah.
Through the streets of Leicester?
Yeah, exactly. So, in the context of multiculturalism expressed in cosmopolitan cities such as London, cultural relativism becomes an important phenomenon. Now, Brian Turner argues that this cultural relativism is nothing new. It actually goes back to much earlier, and then of course he shows examples in the 16th century Western Orientalism. In fact, he picks up examples even from Tempest, from the Merchant of Venice. You know, Shylock, for instance, is an embodiment of that Orientalism kind of discourse, really, that unconsciously or subconsciously Shakespeare unleashes these characterizations. He suggests that in the context of multiculturalism, the ideals of difference and recognition are important principles. They become the principles around which you can negotiate multiculturalism. Now, all of this prolegomena that I have sketched out so far is to essentially emphasize not only the need of the Hindus, but the resources with which they constructed their habitus in the West or in the lands of their hosts. Much of their habitus is constructed not through Brahmanical dominant sources, but rather orally transmitted popular sources. There may be Brahmanical elements in these popular orally transmitted sources, but their access to those Brahmanical elements is not necessarily from Brahmanical texts and so on, but rather from other you know, sort of sources, often even Western sources. I mean, a case in point really is Gandhi. Gandhi never had any formal or informal education about his religion other than his maid, who taught him about a few stories about the Ramayana. That's about as much as he knew. And for the first time, actually, after he comes to London, I mean, to England for his bar at law education, barrister education, he reads the Bhagavad Gita, the translation that was retranslated. Wilkins translated in 1776, around there, the first translation of the Gita. And that was retranslated 100 years later by Edwin Arnold in a poetic version. And that's the one that Gandhi reads.
Into Gujarati.
No, English. Sanskrit. No, English.
He reads, see what you mean.
He reads English.
You meant when you said retranslated, I thought you meant back into
Gujarati. No, well, he translated in a kind of modern poetic verse form. Yeah. Arnold being a poet, so he kind of renders a poetic version of it in very powerful kind of poetic language. Wilkinson's one was very typical, sort of bland, Indological translation, you know, very straightforward, literal kind of translation. But Arnold gives that edge, you know, power to that word. So that's what he read, Gandhi. So his introduction to Hinduism was really Edwin Arnold.
That doesn't mean he's not a Hindu. This is conscious.
Yeah.
This is a conscious thing. Mm. I mean, if you spoke to many, anybody from any tradition, their knowledge of such and such text might be sketchy or absent, but nevertheless, they are what they are.
Yeah.
I mean, Gandhi was devoutly Hindu, even though he may not have read the Gita in whatever language.
Yeah. I mean, that's
the conscious recognition of this that we're talking about.
Yeah, but I think in the
but it is true that he wasn't anywhere near so devout a Hindu.
No,
when he came to England,
I agree. He left. But you couldn't challenge him on those grounds.
No.
I think you're pushing it a bit too far there.
It actually raises the question as to how a Hindu could be defined.
His whole experience, when he writes the autobiography, you know, Experiments with Truth, it's from a profoundly Hindu perspective.
But which actually emerged in the context of his interaction with these Christian priests, missionaries.
Consciously through,
while he's writing it, two of his closest confreres are actually.
Yeah. I mean, Becker and others, you know, the missionaries who actually had dialogues with him on a daily basis, actually made him to think about what he was all about.
Mm. I think that's very important because I've given sort of the last 35 years of my life to realizing the importance of that. Not only Gandhi's experience, but the experience that we can have as well. Mm. When we really do seriously take each other's religion seriously.
Mm.
That's actually very important.
Yeah, but I mean, by the time of Vivekananda, he himself was heavily impacted by the Arya Samaj and the Brahma Samaj, all of those, you know, movements. And so he brings all of those ideas in his what he calls Practical Vedanta when he gave that eloquent lecture at the World Parliament of Religions in 1893. Incidentally, that's the year that Gandhi goes to South Africa. You know, this man goes that way and this man goes this way. Things happen, interestingly, by no coincidence. So much of their habitus, I mean, memory is the basic method through which they seem to have reconstructed their traditions, beliefs, rituals, and so on. In fact, if you look at all of these in the mainly, I would hesitate to generalize the case of Britain, but I just put it there anyway, especially in the case of South Africa, Suriname, Trinidad, and Mauritius. You could actually, if you look at that phenomenon, you would think you were in 19th century. the kind of things that you witness in these societies among Hindus, the firewalking, the cavity, etc. Even in India, some of these are actually vanishing so quickly in the urbanization process, in the, you know, people becoming educated and, you know, whole different value systems and so on. And this traditional conventional patronage to these festivals is collapsing in the villages and so on. And when I was a kid, I was hardly about 6 or 7, I remember seeing this, you know, these take place once in 12 years, these what is called the goddess, sort of, what was it called? Some kind of, you know, it's a kind of Radha Yatra type of sort of procession in the context of the worship of the village goddess. And the procession goes through the town to the outskirts, and that's where they actually perform these sacrifices of animals and all that. And there is this guy who actually is, you know, he's supposed to have been possessed by the goddess. He's seated in this cart. He's kind of drawn. And above the cart, all kinds of things are sort of placed, food and, you know, it's like a mountain of rice, actually. And chicken and everything is kind of tied all around. And he's kind of carried to the end of the town, to the outskirts, and he's left overnight. So he stays there throughout the night, and then it's believed that the goddess comes and eats that food, and he is the priest. He offers, you know, the food, and he does these sacrifices, and then early morning he returns to the village, and then there will be another ritual celebration and all of that. And I saw that about when I was 6 or 7, and I never saw that again until I left India. And then years later I went, sorry, Andhra Pradesh, and years later I go to South Africa and suddenly see this kind of something that I thought I would never see again, firewalking, Draupadi Amman ritual, powerful, except it didn't have the same kind of, you know, kind of local vernacular touch to it, because here in the context of India you have the caste, you know, social stratification expressed very powerfully in the procession. The untouchables actually play out the role of the caste Hindus, especially the Brahmanical and so on. This actually happens even today in the Ram Leela, you know, in Ramnagar, Ram Leela festival. What happens is it is allowed for these untouchables to mimic the roles of the Brahmanical, you know, people and ridicule them. Mm-hmm. They're all standing and watching them.
South Africa,
in South Africa, you don't see that, but, you know, yeah. In India, those are the absence of those elements, because there is no caste structure in the diaspora that you can really trace. So that kind of element falls away. But other than that, the other elements are all there. You know, the power of the, you know, deity, the sacrificial things and all of that. It's very fascinating to see these things and document what's going on in society. I mean, anthropologists actually call this as a kind of implicit reification and re-emphasizing of the orthodoxy. In other words, although in that few hours of that procession they are allowed to question the Brahmanical orthodoxy by ridiculing them, calling them names, and, you know, it gets very, very vulgar, actually. And then after the ritual is over, everyone knows where it is, you know, where one goes. So the next day you do that, you'll be finished. you can't. So in the context of that orchestrated, highly structured kind of place, it's allowed. So it's a kind of, the way I think about it is a way of the orthodoxy allowing self-critique from within that society. In other words, willingly the Brahmanical order of society allows itself to be critiqued by the others in that context.
By which they're ultimately reaffirmed.
Ultimately they are reaffirmed again. I mean, on the Shivaratri night, everything turns upside down. You know, if you go to Andhra, Tamil Nadu, anywhere else, everything turns upside down.
Holi
is the other one. Homosexuality, you know, orthodox girls going out with these boys, you know, all of that sudden mixing up everything you can think of. And morning breaks, everything is usual, normal. Nobody knows what happened. So, I mean, such, apparent contradictions actually, you know, are explained, you know, in different ways, but I think, you know, it's a kind of a internal way of dissipating tension, dissipating, you know, sort of all kinds of built-in sort of tensions and so on. What I want to actually do in the rest of the time that we have is to kind of raise some of these questions. I want to raise these questions for us to talk about and see what we think of all of these things. The first question that I raised earlier, but I will raise again, is there a continuity of some original substratum in the new inventions of rituals? Can an essentialist construction of Hinduism help us understand global Hindu developments? The second one is, in the light of Hinduism in the diaspora, how do we define Hindu or Hinduism? I've given a few examples at the bottom. What resources would constitute as materials to teach Hinduism today? Who speaks for Hindus? Insiders, outsiders, scholars? Who is a Hindu? You know? Do insiders really know their traditions, or do outside scholars really know more than what they should? All of these are thorny questions and debatable, and much can be said on both sides. Look at, for instance, the example of Madan Mohan Malviya in 1921 in the founding document of the Hindutva. He defines, the Hindu means any person, male or female, professing to be a Hindu or following any religion of Indian origin, including Sanatanis. Now, this is in the context of already established Arya Samaj Sanatanis debate. Sanatanis, Arya Samajis, Jains, Sikhs, Sikhs, Buddhists, and Brahmos, that is Brahma Samaj people. Now, that's a pretty, you know, broad, you can't get any broader than that. Yeah. Well, he actually consciously took Muslims and Christians out of the equation. Now, interestingly, I'll open that debate. Interestingly, that's the definition that was placed in the Constitution of India post-1947, in 1950. And that's precisely why Ambedkar chose to go for Buddhist.
Yes.
Conversion to Buddhism rather than Christian or Muslim. He could have become a Christian quite easily. Because the 19th century Christianity converted virtually all the Chamars in that region, in Maharashtra and Bihar, everywhere. So bulk of his community actually became Christian. But then he went to Buddhism because what the constitution stipulated was, using this as the basis, that all religions that emanated out of India, that originated out of India, could still practice some form of caste system, whereas Christianity and Islam, by their, you know, sort of own admission, would not practice caste. So if you became a convert to Christianity or Islam, you lose the caste.
They were treated as castes.
Huh? Yeah.
They were treated as castes.
You mean Christian and...
Yeah.
No, no. For constitutional purposes, they were not treated as castes. They were treated as religions. This is the thing. You know, in the 1860, when the ships came to, you know, South Africa from out of Madras and Bombay, the first four ships never listed castes. But they had religion as a category, and they distinguished Christian, Malabari. Malabari could mean Arab or, you know, Christian, you know, Christian or Muslim. And then they used a very complicated term, Gentoo, for Hindus. Well, Gentoo was probably a corrupt word from Gentile or whatever. You know, it's a broad term, heathen, Gentile. And in 1776, Klostermeyer makes reference to this in his book. 1776, there was a book known as the Customs and Beliefs of Gentoos, something like that. There was a book available in Madras Presidency in India, already in circulation. So the currency of the term Gentoo was in place because the Hindus were considered Gentiles, you know, heathen. And so therefore, that's the term they use. And no caste, you know, terms were present, you know, to indicate which caste came to these places. It's only after 1870, 75, the ships begin to provide some information of caste. You know, even that was very sketchy because people were also dubious about their caste because they were changing their caste statuses.
I'm not sure why you're using these facts to show that back in India at the same time the caste was not enforced necessarily throughout.
The changing situation about caste in the 19th century was so complex that not only people were acquiring caste when they move out, but also in the context of the nationalist movement subsequently after 1857, after the, you know, the Sepoy mutiny, the first war of independence as they called it in India. The nationalist movement began to, you know, emerge. And in that context, it was essential, or there was a need, greater need, to kind of garner support from the broader Hindu. So they wanted to include as much as possible virtually everybody in that category of Hindu. So, yeah. You were saying?
No, oh, actually. I was thinking.
I thought you indicated your hand. Yeah. So that's why the definition of Hindu gets so broad. So if we have that as broad as that, now how do we now use that kind of definition today? And especially in the context of the diaspora, where caste is no longer used as a criterion to define Hindu in the classical sense, in the textual kind of sense, definitions of caste would have to include some understanding of caste, because that has to do with ritual obligations, ritual relationships, and so on. So within the context of ritual, castes are related in certain ways through job descriptions. They had certain professional obligations in the context of the temple and the rituals and so on. So who is who in the context of that ritual is important, And so you define Hindu in that sense. And last time I referred to this case when a particular caste in South India, for instance, when they became Christian, they said they would no longer perform that ritual duty in the temple. And then the temple went to court, and then subsequently the judge, being a Christian European judge, decided in favor of this caste group rather than in favor of the temple, arguing that they have now given up caste. So they are no longer obligated to perform this thing. So in that context, the definition of Hindu was one thing. But then in the changing scenario of the British India, especially in the context of the nationalist movement and so on, the Hindu notion was broadened. And then in the context of diaspora, you would have to work that concept in different ways, actually. Who is Hindu? On the one hand, say, for instance, in South Africa, you have a strong Sanatanist Arya Samaj kind of division among themselves. And in between, the ISKCON comes in and says, we are not Sanatanist in this sense. Because, you see, they are coming from a different angle. We are the eternal Dharma. We are the essential, you know, the original Sanatana Dharma, and so on. So they are, it's hard to kind of now place the Hare Krishna, the ISKCON kind of definition as to where they fit in this, because they came later into the debate in the 70s. And now this debate, Samaj, Arya Samaj and the Sanatanist debate, was back in, what, 1905, 1907, with the RSMR coming into South Africa, the Bhai Parmanand and others. So it gets very complicated as to who then, who, yeah.
I was thinking perhaps another way to look at the idea of being a Hindu goes back to perhaps territorial integrity, or conceptualizing what, or where Hindus live. Perhaps even the idea that, going back, I mean, at the time of Ashoka, already if you're looking at the way the pillars are represented, actually, they really conform more or less to the idea of the subcontinent as we have it today. There was already an idea that the people living, you know, within the confinements of those pillars were, you know, part, integral of maybe Hindus or whatever. But perhaps one, you know, referring to like one particular type of people, perhaps, in a very broad sense. And that obviously doesn't take into account religious, you know, factors or...
You mean in some racial sense or tribal sense?
Yeah, in a sense of perhaps just, you know, nation-state. I mean, might be exaggerated perhaps to use that formula, but something, you know, to that effect.
Well, in a sense, if you are operating within India, that would be, in a way, a sense you would get. You can't get away from that racial kind of connotations or caste as a kind of a mark, marking of that, you know, sort of, because you have to be, first of all, an Indian, you know, to be in that sense. And in fact, this is back in the 80s. I had precisely the same problem in, because for me it was still new as to how to work this out. And we were in a seminar. Jerry Larson was doing this seminar on Indic, this thing. And then my friend, he was like you, Advaitin. And, you know, he thought of himself as, he's a European, he thought of himself as a Hindu. So Jerry went around asking people, how do we define Hindu? So everybody gave a definition, and then I gave this classical kind of definition. And then he said, well, no, I am a Hindu. Then I asked him, how? I said, you can be Hindu, I said. Because I couldn't see him as Hindu, although he could be Hindu in some kind of ideological or whatever sense. But for me, it meant at the time, how do you separate what you're saying, that Indian mass, you know, somehow some kind of a racial something, there is that something extra to that Hindu, because it has these caste affiliations, ritual obligations, and some stratification status, you know, in that society. So outside that society, how do you call somebody else Hindu and then yet relate that person to this broader society? So I think that that's now kind of is the problem. That's, you know, the diaspora context is bringing in all these other elements. You not only have Indians as Hindus, but you have, you know, others, you know, whole range of people. I mean, in South Africa, for instance, even Arya Samaj people have converted a lot of African, you know, black people, and they are practicing Hindus. And ISKCON has members of African people as members of Hindu, you know, in their temple and so on. Yeah. So they then the definition then moves beyond this ethnic kind of tendencies. So ethnicity is kind of separated in the definition of Hindu in the contemporary world. You have to, because otherwise you can't make sense of the variables that you have.
Mm. On the other hand, or rather on two other hands, because one left, one right, the Gandhi movement from, what, around about the 1950s, 1920s onwards anyway, was very strict about detaching the whole concept of caste from Hindu spirituality and loyalty as they saw it. And at any rate in Gujarat, which is the only place I've really been, I get the impression that while it's still there, I mean, everybody will say, of course, caste, but it does. But it's less applicable there than it is amongst the Gujarati diaspora, in my own term.
Yeah, I would buy that. Yes. Yeah. Because Gujaratis, even in South Africa, are very, very caste conscious, and I think one reason how they maintained that was by continuously bringing their marriage partners from India.
Yes.
And they made sure they brought them from the same village, same caste.
Whereas I know a lot of mixed caste marriages in Gujarat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in Gujarat, you won't see it. I mean, this is the irony that was played out in that movie, A Girl from India, made in the 70s or early 80s. This Gujarati family, you know, very orthodox and so on, and goes, you know, this man sends for this alliance from Bombay, Gujarati family, and then this girl comes from that, they thought she is very traditional and so on, and she comes here to UK, to London, and then she is, lo and behold, you know, much more modern than anybody, you know, raised here. I mean, if you go to Delhi campus and see these girls, they're as modern as any, you know, London university girls here. Yeah. I mean, you don't think, I mean, the language they use, the you know, the terms they, you know, all the lingo, everything, you know, the dress, everything is pretty Western. And hanging out in the clubs at night, it's, you know, you would think that these are very modern and so on and so forth. I think caste is constructed differently, and caste rules change even in India. And I think one of the naive things that we have sort of inherited through Dumonian type of sort of construction of caste, using purity and pollution as the polarity, was to somehow reify a certain, essentialize a certain type of caste category and not see other ways of constructing it. Because if you use purity pollution And Nicky Marriott also, in a way, kind of buys into the same thing. But if you look at, say, Kashmiri Brahmins, now, how do you use purity pollution definition in the context of them? They eat meat, they eat goat meat or anything. Maharashtrians eat meat. Bengali Brahmins love their fish, you know. Now, what's happening here? So where is, what kind of purity pollution are you talking? So if you actually, Maharashtra is here, Bengal is here, and Kashmir, if you draw that kind of a triangle and cut out that northern Vindhya mountains, you know, north of Vindhya range, that area is probably meat-eating belt, really. Yeah, well, Gujarat, except the Banyas, and I actually doubt the population of Brahmins there. It's not as much, they may be like about 1%, not even 1%. And then you come down south, Brahmins are very, very conservative. There is no very strict vegetarian, you know, upbringing and so on. Michael Witzel has a kind of a theory about this. He says that as Brahmins, even a Kashmiri Brahmin, if he comes south, he will practice very strict vegetarian diet. They uphold. And that's why for most of the rituals, when they do special kind of rituals, they take South Indian Brahmin priests to the north as well to perform them. So there is a kind of a distinction made between these various things. So if you use that kind of Dumonian, you know, purity pollution type of thing, then it becomes very difficult to kind of add up all these variables and see what's coming.
But you've defined, I mean, I'll just copy that down, you've defined caste as ritual obligations.
Yeah.
So if you don't use these kind of polarities, I mean, your argument, you've reversed it really, because if the North Indians come down and observe the South Indian practices, then they are consciously then putting into practice the old purity pollution. It's become to their, you know, they're bringing it, they're actually reinforcing it. If you don't have that, what's your alternative in defining ritual obligations if it isn't purity and pollution, if it isn't correct performance of ritual? What is incorrect performance of ritual if it isn't purity?
Well, pollution? Except in the context of North Indian, especially the Maharashtrian, you know, Kashmiri and Bengali context, ritual obligations may not necessarily be driven by purity pollution.
No, but if it's correct, I mean, rituals are either you perform it correctly or incorrectly. Hmm. Isn't that a version of the more abstract notion of purity? You know, you're performing it according to rule and you're not deviating.
No. I'm talking about purity pollution in kind of touch and untouchability.
Sure.
Kind of, you know. Touch,
physical
kind. In other words,
physical
contact. Physical contact pollutes somebody, and it doesn't pollute somebody else. In other words, between physical contact between Brahmins does not pollute, but physical contact between a Brahmin and a Shudra or anybody else would cause pollution. But then there are other variables. He can come in contact with a washerman.
But in the context
in a
of
certain
the example you gave of meat eating or not meat eating, how does that, can you explain works with contact?
Perhaps in the context of, say, for instance, Kashmiri Brahmins, meat eating probably is not necessarily a criterion to describe pollution, contact, you know, this thing, because the so-called untouchables may also be eating, but there may be other ways of distinguishing features of contact or non-contact, and hence some kind of stratification.
Why does the North Indian Brahmin, and when he comes south, observe vegetarian?
Because of the association of, in other words, he has to now level with the South Indian Brahmin in terms of practice.
But why is it the South Indian Brahmin is the criterion of orthodoxy and not the...
Well, this is a broader question of Hindu. in other words, Hinduism tended to somehow buy the idea of vegetarianism,
yes,
profiling vegetarianism as the key element of... Well, I think that has to do with the post-Buddhist Jaina influence.
Yes.
In other words, until that time, I don't think...
It wasn't an issue.
It wasn't an issue. I don't think it was a major issue. They might have been in isolated areas, but I think it wasn't described as a pan-Hindu kind of phenomenon. So suddenly
In any case, those traditions were, at least in part, a protest against the Vedic sacrificial rituals, weren't they? And clearly can't be.
Yeah.
Vegetarian in the modern sense, don't you?
Yeah. But in a sense, I think to say that they were a kind of a reaction to Vedic ritualism is, of course, it's true, but I think there are more other kind of complicated sort of things there than, but anyway, we don't want to get into that. And that's a big interlogical debate. Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm going back to the meat thing, especially in Kashmiri Shaivism, we have to take into account tantric, obviously.
Exactly.
Well, you have the Kaula.
The five M's is key in the Tantra tradition.
So is
in Bengal and Assam. I think this triangle that I drew is connected by Tantra, really.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Because Bengal, Assam, and Kashmir, and to a certain extent this way, the Punjab, that belt, is connected by the Tantra belt, And so you have that kind of tantric Hindu, tantric Buddhist, tantric Jaina, kind of all of these variations. Mm-hmm. And Tantra as a common kind of fabric. And South was, in a way, South has somehow sublimated Tantra, through their agamic, appropriation. See, agama is a kind of, if you wish, a sublimated version of the Tantra tradition. We were talking about this in the morning, class, Hinduism one class. But anyway, the issues are much more complex there, actually. You have a whole range of other things you have to explain, Sramana traditions and the highly esoteric Tantra tradition and the sublimated Agama and all of those things.
I'm curious now, what was Michael Witzel's?
Well, he simply says, there is no hard and fast rule, actually. It's a kind of a geographical condition that necessitated these people to eat meat, Kashmiris and so on, the weather patterns and so on. And then when they come down south, they change. Because they have to now look orthodox with these other Ayers and Shastris and, all these people. And B, the temperature doesn't require them to eat.
Yeah.
The climatic conditions are not really conducive to meat-eating kind of thing. And I think it's more actually to do with this social thing rather than climatic thing when they come down south. Because suddenly they have to, if he says Brahmin, he has an idea of what a Brahmin is, South Indian Ayer or Iyengar or whatever. Now, if this guy is suddenly seen in the restaurant eating, all these steaks, now he's not going to see him next day. He won't even let him in the house.
So to be accepted,
So it's the acceptability and, that kind of thing.
So is there a substratum Brahmin?
There are hundreds of those substrata.
Yeah.
Brahmin is a highly variegated kind of group itself.
Mm.
And you have not only the... among the Iyengars themselves... Vasantharangachari is not here.
Mm.
She probably could comment more. among themselves, different Iyengars don't marry. While everybody could be described as Sri Vaishnava, not everybody is an Iyengar. Mm. All Iyengars are Sri Vaishnavas. Not all Sri Vaishnavas are Iyengars. So again, within Iyengars, you have stratification. And I still have to find explanation to this group that Ramanuja converted, these hill tribes,
mm-hmm.
up at Melkote. And he made them priests. Now, you know, this happened like, say, now this is 11th century.
Mm-hmm.
So in these 900 years or so, what happened to these people? How did they become integrated in society? Where are they? Have they now become, are they now part of the Iyengar community,
mm.
who were one time tribal people?
They're
so
conspicuous by their absence in the list, aren't they?
So they must be somewhere, and I'm sure they were stratified. Because one thing that India does is, whoever comes into India is reified and stratified. Parsis come in, and they become a caste. You know, within no time, they become a caste. And there was between 12th century or 11th century onwards, the Mughals brought a whole bunch of African slaves, not necessarily as menial labor, but also as army soldiers and so on and so forth through India. And they still exist in Maharashtra and Karnataka belt as an identifiable caste group. They are known as Negroes. There's a caste called Negro in Karnataka. And they speak a kind of a mixture of, you know, Karnataka and they have other vocabulary in there. Local people don't know that. Only this, you know, caste speaks that
language. Yeah. Well, I was saying also the example of Sri Lanka, which is supposed to be Buddhist, is similarly caste stratified.
Mm.
I met an African there who was, again, who'd been a slave. And yet was now in a caste.
Yeah.
And yet he was non-Buddhist as well. So
yeah.
It seems to be a social thing which is in the subcontinent. But it's there again, if you say that, then it's not peculiarly Hindu.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it might be something.
Yeah.
It's something.
Yeah. It manifests in different ways in other cultures.
In different cultures.
Raises an interesting philosophical question as to whether the caste system is about social inclusion or social exclusion.
Yeah.
And probably more the former.
Oh, yes.
Mm. Professor, a couple of things I noticed. One, you talked about the rise in spirituality. I was wondering whether this isn't very much a kind of more Western perspective on religion and belonging. And following off on from that, I one thing I really noticed, when you said that the death, I think, tell me if I got you right or wrong, that actually, because Hinduism was defined largely in terms of caste, therefore it was an ethnic or racial kind of idea of identity. I was rather surprised by that, and I wondered whether or not we weren't overlooking the fact that actually ideas similar to caste have existed outside of Hinduism. I read one book called, I think it was called India Britannica, and the author made the rather interesting observation that when the British went to India, they were united by a very similar classification of society. And actually, a lot of the divisions when the British were there were more, or the tensions were largely, were more between the different classes than between the British and the Indians very often. So would it be right to say that that kind of identification of Hinduism with what you could call broadly the caste system, although I don't like that term, it's a foreign term, is actually racial and ethnic? Isn't it more of a class system in a way?
You mean the very caste system was, well, it was justified along those lines in any case, you know, that each caste has, under the Varna system, you know, they had these different professions to perform in a society.
Yeah.
Mm. And hence, goes back to ritual. You know, in ritual context, these professions are actually expressed and manifested, you know, clearly. Because, you see, if you're looking at the ancient Indian structure, everything revolved around these various rituals that people performed. So everybody had a role, and then that role determined as to what they actually did for their daily living.
Well, those religious rituals.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So
I think I get that from the Bhagavad Gita. I think I get a different argument.
From the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah. Well, yeah, then you get this philosophical kind of notion of caste and, you know, the other thing. We are then talking different things. I mean, but if you're talking about social stratification, India, you know, that's the basis. And that's why the difficulty for most social scientists is to use these four generic terms to classify Indian society. The Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra classification doesn't really make sense. Because a person who claims Kshatriya status is usually, for census reports, described as Shudra. You know, Pathans in, you know, Rajputs, for instance, they claim Kshatriya status, but then they are described as Shudra.
By whom?
The British census. Well, it is kind of locally acquired, sort of this thing, because when you come to South, it gets even more complicated. Who is a Kshatriya? Reddys, Kamas, all these people were actually land-owning people. And then they also had lineages connected to, you know, at one time Reddys were kings. But today they are just basically land-owning people. They cultivate land and so on, and so they are classed as Shudra. And the so-called caste in, you know, Andhra, for instance, Rajulu, there is no memory of royalty in those communities. But they are, I mean, like Satya Sai Baba comes from that Raju caste. But there is no memory of anybody in, you know, in the history. You go 1,000 years or whatever, you know, they call themselves Rajulu. And they're classed as Kshatriya.
There was an attempt to get status, was it?
Well, you see, the local variables are very different. And kings actually acquired Kshatriya status in most parts of India. And that's why you have this tradition of either Lunar dynasty or the Solar dynasty. So as soon as somebody, you see, kings always depose somebody and they become a king. Pandians did that, Cholas did that, and so on. And then the moment he becomes king, this priest will then recite lineage of that he belongs to this, you know, Chandravamsa or Suryavamsa, one of those. So that's how you claim Vedic lineage. So he then traces. And this lineage is very important. If you, you know, if any of us go to a temple here, nobody will ask this question. But if you go to any temple in India, especially I know the South better than the North, the first thing they would ask you is your Gotra. What is your Gotra? Of course, if you're a white man, they may not ask you because, you know, they will assume that. But if I go, they will ask me, what is your Gotra? If she goes, she will ask, I mean, they will ask her, what is your Gotra? She may not have a clue because her parents never told her anything about it. And the Gotra has a relationship with a particular family deity. So that's the reason why he's asking. Indirectly, he could ask, what's your family deity? You know, Shiva or Vishnu or whatever. But he wouldn't ask family deity. He would ask, what is your Gotra? Bharadwaja or, you know, all these Gotra. You have to link to that, and then thereby link to the Vedic.
Why is that? Why do they ask them? Is it just for economic reasons? I heard it like.
No. The rituals are performed in relation to your social.
But for instance, at Jagannath Puri, I heard that the reason why they wouldn't let white people in is because they can't agree for the different people who take from the different areas, the different castes. They show them around the temple, and they get quite a bit of money. But
they couldn't agree among themselves who they were going to take the white people on.
Yeah, there are some temples restrict, and for a while I think the Venkateswara temple used to, I don't know now, but they used to restrict Europeans. But local temples don't, I mean like smaller temples, like if you go to a relatively smaller temple, it may be big in that locality, but they don't worry. But in these prominent big temples, you know, where there is this established ritual hierarchy and all that, they're very, very strict about these things.
Interesting that you have like very orthodox figures like Shankaracharya, who really, I mean, obviously see the caste system as within the Dharma, and would actually assert that Dharma is not fixed. The Dharma is really kind of like always changing, and it, you know, according to times and conditions. So that kind of perhaps I think concur with what you're saying.
Yeah, and social science,
not, you know.
Yeah.
A kshatriya may one day become a kshatriya or something.
Yeah. In most cases, even Brahmanical statuses were acquired.
Mm.
You see, it is steeped in, you know, kind of couched in various ways. Now, a case in point is this conversion that Ramanuja did. They became Brahmins eventually, these tribal people. Where are they now? So they must be somewhere absorbed into this Iyengar Brahmin society. But I know, in terms of marriage, they can distinguish who it is. They can. And I have a feeling the ones that have this last name Butter are the ones that Ramanuja appointed as priests in these temples. And usually the orthodox Iyengar Brahmins have either Acharya or Alvar, the two names. You know, like if the father is Acharya, the son becomes Alvar, then his son becomes Acharya, and then so on and so forth. Because it's because of this dual Vedanta tradition in that community.
So would that mean that Bhattas or Bhattars in, say, Sri Rangam today have migrated from Melkor?
My hypothesis, because Brahmanuja appointed them all over. You know, because wherever he transformed the temple rituals along the lines of Pancharatra, he made sure, of course, in those days he probably didn't give them the important key ritual positions, but somewhere at the lower strata he put them as to perform certain rituals. But over time I have a feeling that they may have acquired a little higher status. But for instance, the Narasimha Bhatta in Melkote Sanskrit Academy, he is a highly learned pundit, and his brother performs rituals in the temple, in the main temple. So, and of course it becomes very problematic to unpack these things, because community wouldn't want to open up the can of worms, you know, because they have integrated.
Were you originally a tribal?
Yeah.
I have a theory.
By saying you're illegitimate, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a good theory, isn't it? Get out of here.
Professor, I just wanted to ask one other question, if I can. I mean, again, coming to this idea that Hinduism is an extremely racial designation, and I probably don't like it because I'm not from the Hindu race.
Well, certainly from the way Malviya defined, it doesn't seem like racial. Because he kind of liberated it. But then, of course, he was hitting the Christian and the
Indian origin.
Yeah.
We sometimes have
it's pretty racial.
Well, but I think for him it didn't seem like racial in the sense of the other caste.
But we seem to have this idea that kind of with the kind of postmodernism or late modernism, whatever you call it, that, you know, there weren't those dynamics going on years ago. But I heard that Hinduism spread to Indonesia very early on, and by the 5th century had been well established. Now, were those people Hindus by race, or were they mixing with others so that the racial boundaries were very, very fuzzy? I would have thought they were. So
they must have intermarried also.
They must have been. So you can't really say it was strictly racial in definition, even at that time, which is quite early on, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you use the racial definitions, then you exclude Cambodian Hinduism, you exclude in a whole range of other Hindu, because you see, the South Indian kings traded with all these places way back 7th century, 8th century and so on. So they exchanged ideas. Priests went in the, you know, shipping expeditions and so on, so they then, you know, found themselves there. So that's how religion went and then becomes developed there. But I think the definition of this thing vis-a-vis caste is peculiar to India, really. And it actually has to do with Indian social stratification rather than, and there are attempts to kind of de-link religion from this definition by social scientists. I mean, like, say, for instance, somebody like, what's his name? Professor Gupta from Deepankar Gupta. He thinks there is no caste in India. He's a political scientist. And he married a non-Brahmin. And, you know, he says, in a practical sense, where is the time to practice caste in modern India?